Thank you, Keith, Nicola, for your speeches. Those, they were very interesting. So now we open the floor for your questions. Back there, I have one question. I can see you very well.
Hi there. It's Dominic Nash here from Barclays. Thanks for your presentation. Three questions from me, please. Firstly, on RIIO-T3, in the draft, I think you've got 5.65 real return. Can you just tell us whether you think that was good enough? And earlier today, I think we were given guidance on your blended sort of 9.5% achieved regulatory RORE, the 8.5 was going to be expected from the UK. Can you just give some colour as to whether that that doesn't seem like very much outperformance versus the 5.65? You give some colour on that. The second question I've got is when you're in the room with all your energy ministers and Ed Miliband and all the rest of it, and I noticed that you had three priorities: energy security, economic growth, and decarbonisation. Can you let us know what impact on bills do you think all this spend is going to have? And are you worried that the UK consumer will be able to take that? And then finally, could you just give us some colour on data centres and what conversations you're having with data centres connecting to your networks and sort of the scale of that, please? Thank you.
Sure, thank you. So look, on T3 and the 5.65, obviously you inflate that up. So if you do that at 2%, that's up to 7.7. Okay. Ofgem right now are saying in the T3 draft they believe there are 200 basis points of incentives for us to go after, and that's one of the main conversations now with Ofgem between now and the final determination. One is about the base cost of equity and pushing that, but secondly it's then about making sure there's greater clarity on the deliverability and achievement of the incentives and the incentive mechanisms. And there's still quite a lot of work to do there with Ofgem. The good thing is the three transmission companies were very, very strongly aligned. We're all in asking for exactly the same thing. We're in asking for exactly the same clarity. In fact, when we met the chair of Ofgem yesterday, he quoted back to us almost virtually what we were saying to him from a conversation he'd had with National Grid. So it's a big, strong message. What I would say is, you know, the draft determination is good. If you go back to T2, when we were sitting with the draft determination, I think the expression we used with the regulator was they hadn't just missed the target, they'd actually missed the wall the target was stuck on. For T3, the draft, we're all in the same ballpark. We're there, we're close. It's about getting more clarity on the incentives, it's about getting more certainty about how you achieve those incentives, and it's a bit of a conversation around cost of equity. So we are confident we'll get a bit more movement, but we're headed in the right direction with them. On conversations with energy ministers and secretaries of states, etc., around security and decarbonisation, look, the conversations are all very positive, but clearly, you know, politically, all politicians, ministers are looking at costs, cost to consumers, they're looking at inflation, they're looking at the economy as well. I think Ofgem had stated when they looked at T3 and the network investment that it could add about £54-55 to an average bill. That's about 17 pence a day. Okay. Now, 17 pence a day doesn't sound like much, but £54-55, you know, that's the kind of number that starts to bother people. All right. If we do what we're saying we're going to do, which is we get rid of the constraints on the system, that puts £55 back in to the consumer's pocket because it reduces the cost of running the system. We create the jobs, we create the value, we create the manufacturing in the back of this. We directly are employing another 1,400 people. Our supply chain are employing somewhere between 10 and 12,000 people. And again, it's those jobs that create that. The apprenticeship scheme, you know, Nicola talked about, we're bringing more apprentices in. When you go around communities, I know people might want to have conversations about bills and they have conversations about community benefit, but if you tell people their children are going to get a job and they're going to get trained in a career for a life, that is of huge value to people as well. And that's what we're going to do and what we're going to deliver right across the country. We're going to get people into work, we're going to get youngsters straight out of school, earning an income, earning, getting a training and getting a career for life, delivering this future system and the future network, which is brilliant. On data centers, there are lots of conversations just now. You'd have heard on the back of the state visit of the US president, a huge wave or promise of wave of investment from AI companies, data center companies wanting to invest in the UK. And that's one of the great things for us. That is driving the political conversation. It's driving the economic growth conversation, which is this country needs this infrastructure we're going to build. Otherwise, that investment cannot happen. And again, that's a huge part and a huge boost of what we're doing is we will allow the UK economy to grow by delivering this investment. There are also specific conversations going on with the government about data centres and specific areas and specific zones, and we're involved in those conversations as well. Do you want to add anything?
No, nothing specific to add. I mean, I think on that affordability point, the way that we can get bills down in the long term, part of the answer is investing in networks. And I think, thankfully, you know, government and regulation is lined up in that. And it's about making sure that consumers understand the impact. So it's the headlines in terms of the cost, you can make, you know, that 50-odd pounds. But when you look at that long-term benefit, by investing in networks, we can potentially help move the country towards security of supply as well and decouple us away from that reliance on fossil fuels in Europe and therefore have less price volatility. So for the long term, then absolutely the right thing is to continue to invest in networks.
Thank you. Thanks, Dominic. Javier Garrido here.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. I will have two questions. One is specific on RIIO-T3. One of your peers is not particularly happy with the capitalization ratio in the draft determinations. What is your views about that specific topic? And the second question would be, Keith, you have mentioned about further clarity needed on incentives, but I guess that's also on the flip side on penalties. And I was wondering what sort of risk would you see at this stage of not getting enough clarity and that jeopardizing some of your investment projects, because we are talking in some cases of very long-term, very complex pieces of infrastructure that historically have seen delays and could see delays. How big a risk you would see of not getting enough clarity and not feeling comfortable with delivering some of those complex pieces of infra? Thank you.
Okay, fine, good. So on our competitor, I won't talk about our competitors directly and where they are, but obviously each company has its own challenges. We're in a very fortunate position being part of the Iberdrola group, and as Pepe made it very, very clear, we have the money secured. We know we can make these investments and deliver these projects. The capitalization rates for us are fine as a company. But each company has a different situation and a different challenge to tackle in terms of the size and scale of their investment compared to their funding availability and their capitalization rates. In terms of incentives and penalties, the great thing about the mechanism, about the RIIO mechanism, is it has built into it incentives, and that was always part of it. It was about outputs and delivering outputs. When I say we're looking just for some further clarity on them, it's really just the detail of how some of the incentives work. So for instance, we would like a little bit more of an incentive and a bit more clarity around a connections incentive, because what we're saying to Ofgem is if the government, the government are saying we want this, we want it done on time, then you should be incentivizing us to hit connection dates and make that clearer. The incentives just around some of the innovation programs aren't particularly clear in terms of exactly how they get triggered and how they work. We are confident that will get sorted out by the time we get to final determination, because these also have to be referenced to in the license and the license conditions we end up getting. So they will have to give that clarity and give us all of that information. On the penalty side, we always knew, particularly when they brought in the accelerated strategic transmission incentive, the ASTI projects, there would be an upside and a downside, and you know, we need to deliver on time everything that's within our control. Again, there are safeguards built into that in terms of those delivery dates, If it's because of planning issues out with our control, then we get exempt from the penalty mechanism and we get relief. Okay, so we think the balance of that risk-reward is acceptable to us. As I say, we just want a little bit more clarity. In terms of potential delays, you know, what we'd always said to, we said to the previous government and we said to this government, if you fix the planning system, you get stuff through planning. I'd originally said to them I would double our investment. Well, we're trebling our investment. Okay, they need to deliver on that, and that's part of the work we're doing with them. They've made changes to the planning system. We're seeing further changes coming through. There's lots of engagement going on with local communities. But as a country, if the UK wants its economy to grow, it needs to have to learn how to build infrastructure.
James Brand from Deutsche Bank.
I have three questions, actually, and thank you for the presentation. The first is, I think, unforecastable, but I'm going to ask you for a forecast. But the grid service costs, such as redispatch, that you kind of said some people think they could have gone up from 2 to 8 if there was no transmission infrastructure. Where do you think they will go? And obviously, a key determinant of that will be, you know, the next auctions for offshore. But some people are saying we need, you know, 15 gigawatts of offshore, like in the next auction, to hit the 2030 target, which I kind of personally doubt will procure that much. But yeah, are we adding this transmission infrastructure to deal with the renewables that were already there, and we're going to need another wave to deal with the new wave of renewables? But just some thoughts on that would be super interesting, because I don't see many forecasts out there. The second question is on the distribution CapEx. You mentioned that would take a step up at the next regulatory review. Could you give us any detail on where you think that might be going? And then thirdly, obviously building a lot of cables in the UK that go underwater to support future energy demand. But there's obviously been a few incidences of cables being cut. So I was wondering whether you could just share some thoughts on how you or other parties such as the government think about the security risks of building, you know, so many subsea cables. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thanks for the questions. In terms of future constraints costs, so I'm going to start throwing acronyms all over the place in a minute. Apologies. So quite a while ago, there was a piece of work done called HND, the Holistic Network Design, which was driven through the system operator working with the transmission companies. And then there was a second one beautifully called HND2, Holistic Network Design 2. Those design processes took account of the future generation needs and the future build out. And they've also been ratified by the Clean Power 2030 plan. So the current plans for investment in the transmission system, and this is also why we're doing the HVDC subsea cable links, take account of the renewables that have to be built as well as what's currently on the system. Okay? The only real additional thing that's coming into play now is on top of Clean Power 2030 is the conversation about data centers and AI technology. Because the holistic network design and Clean Power 2030, to an extent, were more focused on generation and how it satisfied demand and where we need to shift the power. But what we also need to do is take account of where are the data centers going to go and where are they going to suck power off the system and make sure the grid's also strong enough for them. There's also a huge piece of work going on just now around queue management. So the system operator has now put in place a new process for looking at what sits in that grid queue, because the grid queue is also jammed. That's going to free up to allow more critically important generation projects to come through the system faster and push some of the other projects back up the system. It's kind of quite well documented that there are hundreds of gigawatts of battery projects sitting in a grid queue that are highly unlikely ever to be built. And so they will accelerate other projects on top of those and start shifting the queue around to make sure we get the right stuff built in the right place at the right time. And that all feeds into that Clean Power 2030 plan as well. Delivering that plan will avoid the 8 billion of constraint costs. I'm not going to tell you it gets it to zero, but we'll see. But it will significantly change the constraint management system across the whole of the UK, and that's particularly around those subsea cables. They allow us to shift huge amounts of power north-south, south-north, and that's where a lot of the constraints currently come on the system. In terms of ED3 and the shift to ED3, I think we probably have it in hidden away in some of the slides somewhere, but the likelihood is we think right now you're likely to see a 40 to 50% uplift in CapEx when you move from ED2 to ED3, and that's the big opportunity for us. And it's a brilliant opportunity, because we have the same opportunity now with the ENW. In terms of cables, there's a huge amount of infrastructure under our seabed as a country, not just electricity cables, gas pipes, telecoms, everything. And there is a lot of planning, discussion and control with the UK government around the security of all of those cables, given the criticality for infrastructure. Because we are classified as a CNI business, a critical national infrastructure business, we get direct conversations with the security services and with all of those critical teams in the government about how this gets managed, how it gets controlled, how it gets planned, and how it gets protected. You would have seen, I can't remember, earlier on this year, the Navy chasing a couple of Russian ships away from the UK coastline. It's a constant, ongoing conversation. Okay. Do you want to say anything else, please?
Maybe just pick up a wee bit on the distribution investment. So Keith's right, up to 50% step up from ED2 into ED3. A lot of that is driven by the change in how we use electricity. And the chairman touched on it a bit this morning. If you think about when the distribution network was built, predominantly people used electricity to light their homes. They had a coal fire. They didn't really have much electricity demand. If you look at the requirements for electricity now, particularly when you add electric vehicles and heat pumps into the mix, then our infrastructure needs to be upgraded. And quite often in many of the streets, I think I mentioned the unlooping programme. So this is where the cables that go into people's houses, you need to almost separate them so that you can make sure they've got enough capacity in each home. And there's a programme right across the UK that we are working on to do that. So a lot of that step up is an investment, is to support that that electrification of people's homes and businesses. So that's really what's driving a lot of that big increase.
Whichever you want. Yamed here from Jefferies.
Yes, hi, Ahmed from Jefferies. A few questions from my side. Obviously, the regulation is structured in 5-year sort of time periods, but I wonder if you can just talk about the longevity of the CapEx cycle in transmission, UK transmission. Is this sort of the T3 is where the bulk of the work is done in terms of undersea cables, offshore gets connected, and then it sort of tails off, or are there already markers because of the health of the network, et cetera, that you see that actually this is a much longer duration cycle, even if regulation is just structured in 5-year terms? My second question is just on data centers. Is that a bigger lever for transmission network CapEx or distribution networks? Where does the sort of the incremental investment when we think about the RAB growth and associate that with data center comes in? And then finally, for T3 final determinations, is there sort of any sort of big point of discussion from your side on base cost allowances? And where you need to see significant improvement, or is that not a big point of discussion from your perspective? Thank you.
Thank you. So I'm going to pass some of this to Nicola and Guy. I'll just give you a quick high-level response. Yeah, it's CapEx life cycles do not fit beautifully with Rio 5-year life cycles, okay? So they work in different ways. So projects come in and out of a Rio period. Some of them will have started before the period, go through it. Some of them will start in the period and go out the other end of it, okay? And Guy can talk a bit about the CapEx life cycles of some of the big projects we're doing. you know, because particularly, again, some of the big HVDC projects have got a long duration CapEx investment. On data centres, just briefly, it kind of depends on the size of the data centre, I suppose, quite simplistically. Some of them are below 50 megawatts, they're in the distribution system. A lot of companies are talking about hyper data centres, huge data centres. You tend to find them wanting to focus in and around the southeast of England, where they're up at your 200, 300, 400, 500 megawatt. They'll be transmission connected, okay? Some of them looking for their own power sources, so there's all sorts of complex conversations around them in terms of how they fit in the system, where they fit on the system, and how much power they need to draw down from the system. On a final determination, I'll hand that one to Nicola in terms of what's in the base and what else we're looking for. But Guy, maybe you want to talk about CapEx cycles.
Yes. Good afternoon, Guy Jefferson. So yes, we are moving into a long duration cycle. Our transmission assets in particular can take up to 10 to 15 years from initiation to actual completion. I think Keith alluded to the HVDC links. That's a great example. Obviously, we're due to deliver EGL1 on the East Coast in 2029. But EGL4, which we're currently out contracting for and just secured the major contracts for, is not due to be delivered till 2034. And then Western Link 2, which was briefly touched on by Nicola, is in development at the moment, and we're putting a lot of work into that exciting project, which is not due to deliver to the late 2030s. So we are planning way ahead of the traditional five-year cycle. And to be honest, the five-year cycle is moving towards an end in some ways, because in the past, 80% of our baseline expenditure was agreed in that five-year cycle. In this case, for T3, it will be 20%, and 80% will be uncertainty mechanisms, but many of which you've heard about today already, ASTI, HND, etc., and our CP 2030 projects, for example, are outside that five-year period as well. So we see growth in transmission for the foreseeable future and well into the 2030s and beyond to facilitate the net zero targets that we have.
Just picking up on the T3 final determination and the base CapEx, the draft determination as it currently stands, over 90%, I think it's closer to 94%, of our baseline CapEx already been agreed as part of that draft determination. And in fact, Ofgem commented on the quality of our engineering justification papers. So I think, you know, that's a pretty good response to the quality of the plan that's gone in. And in fact, we did well in terms of the reward for that in the draft determination. So from that perspective, we're fairly confident as we head towards final determination around the base CapEx. There's a couple of areas that we are still in negotiation with Ofgem, and as Keith said, the conversations have been constructive and in line with the rest of the industry. So we are hopeful that we can move things along, particularly on the incentives, where we just need a bit more clarity, because we need to see a way that we can earn that 150 to 200 basis points from incentives. And at the moment, we just need to see a bit more detail in that rather than what's in the draft determination. But the discussions have been positive, and we're hopeful that we'll get there as part of the final determination.
Back here, in the back of the room.
Yeah, it's Richard Alderman, BTIG. Thanks for the presentation. Just following on from those comments about the final determination, I was intrigued in your conversations yesterday with the Ofgem CEO, whether he paid any lip service to any requests you might have for a higher return, base return, and specifically whether he admitted that they would have to take notice of whatever the CMA might say in the next few weeks on the water review. Clearly last week, I think there was a well-informed leak suggesting that the five water companies that are appealing might get something like a 30 basis point uplift in their base returns. So is that providing you with any ammunition for that debate?
Well, yeah, so there are always some good comparators. I think the final decision on the CMA for the water has been pushed back a week or 10 days. I think there was originally an expectation of it coming out this week. And there's always been a kind of comparator between what does the water sector earn and the electricity sector gets an uplift beyond that. we will see where that ends up, and we'll feed that into the conversation. There's also a comparator always done between gas and electricity, particularly around the gearing level, where we're at 55, gas is at 60, and should they be equalised as well. So the regulator's fully aware of those conversations, those dynamics, and the possibilities of where we push that. But right now, you know, our focus is not having to rely on those things, but it's more about the justification of making sure the regulator understands this significant uplift in CapEx and investment, the significance of the delivery timescales. Then that's what should be pushing the returns a little bit higher, and that's what should be pushing clarity around the incentive mechanisms, because we should be getting incentivized to go faster and faster, do more and do it better.
Okay, no more questions? Maybe one last one? No? Okay, then thank you very much for your presentations and your participation in this Capital Markets Day. Thank you to all the participants here who have joined us for the day. Bear in mind that if you have any further questions, your investor relations team is always at your disposal. So do not hesitate to ask. Thanks and good afternoon.